our raise has already been negotiated. The full-timers, the drivers, like, we're going to get ours. We're, you know, 42 is not enough, and we're going to get more than that. We're going on strike because the part-timers are only making 16 an hour, and that's unacceptable. And I will stand next to my part-time brothers and sisters and make sure they get theirs on this one, too. And I'll sacrifice 2 weeks of work if it has to, because that's what solidarity is. That's what we do, all right? And how the hell do you think we got to 42 anyways? By sitting back and accepting 35? Nah. No. We demanded what was ours, and that's what we're doing now. And 42, that's what it is now. In August, when that contract gets signed, we'll have more than that. And it's going to keep going up every year because their profits go up every year.
Yes, folks, that was UPS driver. And we'll just mute that because we always get blown out by the audio. That was UPS driver Juan Trujillo on TikTok. Doing some basic education, and you know, we got a lot to do. For those who are listening, the comment was, "No way you deserve 42 an hour as a delivery guy, lol, take zero skill." First of all, I'd like to see you do it,
yeah,
buddy.
Please.
And I'd like to see what you do for you do all day. But yeah, I mean, we'll talk about more of this in the post game with the writers and actors joining the strikes too, but all these different strikes going on. We need, what we got to do with our independent media, and to the extent we have a constellation around us, is use this as an educational moment, because it's too easy for people to say things like that mm-hmm. to a guy who's going on strike for, I mean, part-time employees, like you said there.
I mean, look, I was talking about this. We talked about this yesterday, Matt, but it was just like, you know, how like Ted Cruz was attacking Mark Ruffalo for like being on the picket line because, oh, he makes millions of dollars. And it's like,
yeah,
literally this is him like showing solidarity and support to other people who aren't getting that. That's mm-hmm. a good thing. And you really have to have your mind infected with some of the worst American anti-solidarity brainworms to not be able to see something like that. It's a very beautiful, noble thing to do.
It's wild, man. Just, oh, you got to open your hearts have been poisoned against the true, like, I don't know. It's like a Disney movie. I feel like, like, come on, guys, you're looking straight in the face of like actual good. And you've been so like perverted by capitalist ideology, frankly, that you're saying shit like that. And like, mm-hmm. look, I would guess that's some kind of crypto guy, some passive income hustler, somebody who doesn't work. If it is a worker, that's just sad, man.
Yeah, 100%. Well, folks, I mean, this is going to be a bit of a tough episode, but an important one. Just before we jump into these stories, remind folks over at patreon.com/leftreckoning. We'll be hanging out immediately after the stream, taking your calls and questions. We also have some RFK DeSantis stuff. By the way, I think I was gone or I was not paying attention too much. I have just seen the I'm hungry video from DeSantis campaign killer right there.
Well, you know the context of that.
No, I do not.
So I don't mean to be the bearer of bad news.
Oh no.
It was from the bad lip reading DeSantis thing. So it's not actually DeSantis.
All right, send that to the Trump war room. Keep it going.
It's fine. Yeah, exactly. Man, I mean, yeah, DeSantis really confirming a lot of things that I'm happy to see confirmed about even the Republican primary electorate. So
true. But anyways, patreon.com/leftreckoning to get access to that. In a little bit, we're going to be talking with Basil Adra, who is a journalist in Palestine, about really horrific mobilization, an attempt for mass expulsion of Palestinians at a level that hasn't been seen since 1967. And it's something that's one both important to pay attention to as like a human being, as an internationalist, but particularly as an American, because it is our money that is funding a lot of these tools of war and this abuse that people are facing there. And, you know, you'll see it in the interview, but he's very adamant about trying to remind this audience about that. But before we go to Israel-Palestine, we're going to start in the South at the Rio Grande. And we're going to talk a little bit about the multi-billion-dollar Operation Lone Star, which is my Governor Greg Abbott's star policy, which has just frankly been a robbery of Texas money, but more importantly, it's humanity. And it has only gotten worse as time has gone on. Abbott has been devising new ways to harass, torture, and maim people fleeing desperate circumstances and coming to this country to try and build a new life. But I know people have probably seen them. I know y'all saw them on Majority Report today, Matt, but these recent revelations have really taken it a step further. And we'll get into those in just a second. As we've covered on this program, the mobilization of the Texas National Guard and Operation Lone Star has been a humanitarian disaster from the outset, frankly, costing the lives of countless migrants and even Texas National Guardsmen themselves. And I thought that maybe that might wake some people up and push some people to start demanding better from the state government. But those, you know, ideas have sort of fallen to the wayside as it's only continued to get worse. Last year, literally last July, it was revealed that the Department of Justice was investigating Operation Lone Star under the Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And I've covered, and if you can have this plane, Matt, I've covered, you know, it's far from the only scandal among deaths of migrants, death of National Guardsmen, lack of payments to troopers on the board, and a whole host of grift and mysterious payments among the billions spent. This thing has been riddled with scandal, and this is the new operation here. They are accelerating it, literally putting up barbed wire across the Rio Grande, putting in these buoys that have barbed wire attached to them so that people who are crossing that river might get tangled, maimed, or hurt. I've covered for Jacobin the way that Greg Abbott has been diverting desperately needed federal COVID-19 funds to these border operations, which again have done nothing to make the border safer, have done nothing certainly to help the migrants. And it's just been an incredible grift. And, you know, this is not the focus of this story, right? The money is not the focus of this at all. But it is unbelievable the amount of people who have been profiting millions of dollars with absolutely zero vetting. And the only real connection or capability that they seem to have to be providing these equipments to the Texas National Guard or the state of Texas is that they're major campaign donors to Greg Abbott himself. But this recent crisscrossing of the border with this nasty barbed wire, with these buoys, is having massive human consequences. I just want to say before we get into this, like, this is not going to stop the movement of people over the Rio Grande. That is a deeply rooted problem at this point. It comes from cash outflows from the Global South into the United States. It comes from purposeful U.S. policy to impoverish people all around the world in the goal of sort of cementing American global hegemony, punishing political actors that the United States doesn't like. None of this stuff that Abbott is doing at the border is going to stop people from crossing, but it will make their lives worse. These are not going to stop people from crossing. It will literally maim people for life and, in the worst cases, cost human beings their very lives. Earlier this week, a Texas DPS medic reported on some of the horrors they have witnessed at the border, saying in the email that they sent to the DPS, saying that there needs to be an investigation of policies on the border, "I believe we have stepped over a line into the inhumane. We need to operate correctly in the eyes of God. We need to recognize that these are people who are made in the image of God and need to be treated as such." And the report, the allegations that he outlines in this report are horrifying. First outlined by the people at the Houston Chronicle, and then also reported by Texas Tribune and other other outlets. This whistleblower reported that on June 25th, when he and other troopers came across a group of about 120 people, including small children and nursing babies who were exhausted, hungry, and tired along a U.S. side, along a fence on the U.S. side. Quote, "We called the shift officer into command and we were given orders to push the people back into the water to go to Mexico." Remember that, you know, the Rio Grande is higher than it has been in a little while recently. The places that are safe to cross now that they put barbed wire, they're not safe to cross, right? The places that people are now trying to cross because they put barbed wire across maybe the lower parts of the river, you know, are filled with water. So literally you're talking about pushing hungry, scared, confused children into a Rio Grande where they very likely could drown and die. Direct order from the Texas Department of Public Safety. He then goes on to say, "We decided that this was not the correct thing to do with the very real potential of exhausted people drowning. We made contact with command again and expressed our concerns, and we were given the orders to tell them to go to Mexico. This is reporting from the Texas Tribune. The trooper wrote in the email that 5 days later, a four-year-old girl who attempted to cross the razor wire was pressed back by Texas Guard soldiers due to the orders given to them. The temperature was well over 100 degrees, and the girl passed out, the email said, adding that she had received medical treatment. Later that evening, Texas troopers found a 19-year-old woman who had become so gashed by this barbed wire in the water that she was having a miscarriage. That body is later found by troopers further down the Rio Grande. The four-year-old girl passed out in 100-degree heat. A man with significant laceration on his leg suffered when he tried to rescue his child from razor wire placed on a deterrence buoy in the Rio Grande. A 15-year-old boy with a broken leg suffered when he tried to cross a more dangerous part of the river away from the buoys. And a 19-year-old woman trapped in the wire was having a miscarriage. There are more stories like that. I mean, it is so deep and disgusting and awful and inhumane, the things that are happening on our border. Another story on July 1st, Border Patrol reported that a mother and her two children were struggling to cross the river. The email said a DPS boat team found the mother and one child who later died at the hospital. The body of the second child was never found. I mean, what can you say about something like that? I mean, it is absolutely horrible what these people are doing to struggling and suffering people trying to cross over in this country to find a better life, to find hope. The confusion, the pandemonium, you know, and add to all of that, the entire journey on the way here, you know, being preyed upon by some of the most vicious people, the people who, you know, are working around, you know, human smuggling. Really dangerous folks, incredibly dangerous situations in Mexico and all the other countries that these people are crossing. The DPS director of Texas, Stephen McCraw, said, "The smugglers care not if the migrants are injured, but we do, and we must take all necessary measures to mitigate the risk to them, including injuries from trying to cross over the wire, drownings, and dehydration." About this email, McCraw calls for an audit of DPS protocols to determine if more can be done to minimize the risk to migrants. I'll tell you right now what will minimize the risk to migrants is picking up all that fucking barbed wire out of the river. Which is very clearly something that is set up to maim and potentially kill people who are crossing over the border. There is no purpose to this other than to harass and to terrorize people. And in these cases, right, this is not even just something that's symbolic. This is something that is physical, that is already lacerating people, that is already causing deaths, that's always already causing drowning. To sit here and say, oh, the smugglers don't care about the lives of these people, but we do, is absolute bullshit when we're getting reports here that people are being ordered by command of DPS to push children into the water. I mean, are you kidding me with that kind of shit? It is so absurd. It is a bald-faced lie to sit here and say that we care for these folks when you're literally putting up weapons of war, militarizing a beautiful part of the earth with these things for the sole purpose of drowning migrants with the intention that it's going to curtail migration. It's not. All that is going to happen is more and more people are going to suffer more than they have already in the first place. You know, the things that caused them to come here.
Yeah. And I mean, this is perpetuating the nightmares of society, because not only is this utterly horrific to whatever degree you want to say in the immediate, you have all of this. I mean, look, I applaud that guy who sent that email, because that is 100% heroic. The ultimate effect of this is going to be coarsening all these guys deployed onto this against that. Like, most people aren't going to be reflective enough to think, oh, what I was doing was actually bad. We've had this entire like literature of like post-Vietnam syndrome, where guys had severe difficulties dealing with things that they were forced to do on the border. And like, also, like you mentioned about the contractor shit, this is money going right to capitalists who are going to invest it right back into politicians and messaging and fear, and the same exact situations that lead to people being put in this sort of desperation in the first place. This is a self-licking ice cream cone of like horribleness.
And it's sickening. I mean, the celebrations of it, like a story like this should be met with absolute horror. Unfortunately, that's not the case. Matt Schaefer, former Texas rep, says, if in fact, this is today, if in fact Governor Abbott is taking a bolder approach to border security by directing DPS troopers to repel illegal crossers. So this is somebody well aware of these stories, right? Well aware of these stories about children being pushed into the Rio Grande, saying, this is a good thing. He has my full support. Every Republican legislator should be speaking up as Dems in the media try to shame Abbott into backing down. This isn't somebody say, hey, we should, you know, taking the line, for example, that the DPS director, Kral, saying, oh, we'll investigate. Oh, you know, we care for these people. No, there's somebody saying that's a good thing that these children are being treated this way. That's a good thing that a young woman with child is having a miscarriage on our southern border because they're lacerated because of barbed wire that our government is putting out there in the water. I mean, it's a height of inhumanity to be able to talk like that, to be able to abstract other human beings' lives like that is one of the more disgusting things that I've seen. And like, I have like a high tolerance for disgusting things for Republicans at this point. I've been doing this long enough to hear the shit that they say. That is something else.
Yeah. Those are like something else. That's like death squad stuff. And you know, it's been going on for a long time.
And DeSantis too has said that, you know, he thinks they should fire live ammunition at people trying to cross the border.
Right. Well, because where does it stop? I mean, Gus Bova had a good reply to that tweet, which is like, all right, name the boldest strategies you're okay with.
Mm-hmm.
Be explicit. Like, let's actually clarify where we're going to stand on, like how much we're going to kill.
So I wanted to, I mean, it's like, it's hard to like even pivot from the, you have to talk about politics, all right? This is politics right here. This is the human consequence of politics, right? Be they defeats of a certain party here, and then the victory of the party in power. This is the end result of politics. This comes from a long line of problems in Texas government, in Texas society, frankly. But remember, I've been trying to write about this and talk about this for a long time. The whole idea that Abbott is able to have this border mobilization is something that the Biden administration should not accept.
Yeah.
No reason they should accept a state governor running parallel border operations to the United States Customs and Border Patrol. It's absurd, right? Yep. There's no reason, legal justification for this. The way Abbott has been able to fund this is through a disaster declaration. So even in the state of Texas, what Abbott is doing is overstepping the legislature, and without giving people civics lesson on Texas government, Abbott has taken a position, which is the governor of Texas, which constitutionally in this state is supposed to be weak, right? It has some power of influence here and there, but the sole power should be residing in the Texas legislature. Abbott has completely flipped the script by using these disaster declarations, by completely dominating the Republican Party. There's no one in the Republican Party who's willing to stand up to Abbott and say, actually, like, we have these powers, right? They've just allowed this to go into Abbott's, you know, under his full control because they like it. They don't mind it. It's not a moral problem for them. But he has completely rewrote the Texas Constitution here. And I think it's important to also understand that what he is doing is not just immoral, it's also illegal. The only person who can stop this, as people have pointed out, somebody who I'm very quick to criticize, Beto O'Rourke, has come out and said the only person who can stop that is the president of the United States. And there needs to be federal action on this because this is happening in all of our names, not just Texans, the entire United States of America. They are allowing Greg Abbott to turn this place into a war zone to torture, maim, harass, and potentially kill human beings coming into this country. Unacceptable in any context, and the federal government absolutely should be getting involved. But I just want
absolutely to sorry, just to jump in real quick there, like this is a test, and the Democrats and Biden need to pass this because the sort of alternate universe where Trump's still in office, I could very easily imagine them fundraising off of this sort of thing, saying, mm-hmm. "Put us in power to change this."
Let's look at a couple of these clips. So let's maybe start on a better one. This is Joaquin Castro, congressman, speaking about these. And I think he speaks very clearly here, and I appreciate this from him.
Yeah.
Greg Abbott posted this on social media. He was showing these buoys that will create a floating barrier in the Rio Grande, the river separating the U.S. from Mexico. The goal, the governor says,
is it coming through? Is it paused?
Crossings.
I think it's coming through. I'll just note for people, the audio is shifted to the left channel. So if you're not hearing it, that's why. We'll mix it down for the podcast.
you make of this? Is there anything that you can do in Congress, if I suppose if you're against it, that you would want to do to stop this? What was your sense of it when you saw this?
Look, Greg Abbott and Republicans in Texas, and really Republicans like Donald Trump and others, for them, the border and immigrants and brown skin immigrants are their number one boogeyman to try to get their base all riled up. And so I want to be clear about this. What Greg Abbott is proposing, or what he intends to put out in that water, are drowning devices. Those things are going to force people to drown. Children, disabled people, mothers, and others. He needs to know, and people who support this need to know, that those things are going to cause people to drown. And that's an inhumanity that I can't support. And so we'll take a look in Congress when we come back early next week about what we can do to try to stop him from doing that.
Man.
That went through?
Oh, yes, yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm not getting it, but that's okay. No, I mean, I think what he says there is absolutely right, that these are drowning devices. And it's purposeful. And that if this is something that you're supporting, if you are somebody like Matt Schaefer out here, who's, you know, for people who don't know, is well known for being a real freak and a psychopath, and this is what you're supporting, frankly. And I think it's good to not mince words on these kind of things. Another example is our esteemed lieutenant governor, second in command, Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, talking about this as well. And, you know, look, you see something like this come out and you would expect, right? I mean, usually there's a kind of a little wink and a nod, right? Oh yeah, we take this very seriously, right? This is pretty exceptional the way he pivots here. So he's going to give you a very political answer. And I just figured we'll play the entire clip so you can see him say, oh yeah, we'll investigate, blah, blah, blah. But see what he pivots to after being laid these kind of charges of what Texas DPS is doing at the border.
The Houston Chronicle reported that the Texas DPS officers on the border have been ordered to push small children and nursing babies on the Rio Grande back into the river and told not to give water to asylum seekers. Is this true? And what is your reaction to an email that the Chronicle reported from a trooper calling this inhumane and that these policies need to change?
Jack, to be candid with you, I have seen the article, but I'm not aware of the email. It's not been brought to my attention personally or in my position as Lieutenant Governor of the state. But of course, we'll look into that. And, you know, it's an email, as I understand, from someone on the border to someone at DPS. And we'll just have to look into it.
Is it concerning to you?
Of course, it would be concerning to me. At the same time, Jack, I will tell you that the reason we put up concertina wire and the reason we're putting the buoys in the river is to stop people from coming. You know, at the last year of Trump, we had the border under control. About 400,000 people or so were apprehended on the border, about two-thirds of those in Texas, because the border is 1,900 miles from San Diego to Brownsville. We're about 1,250 miles of that part. And then in the first year of Biden, it's been 2 million apprehended, or near 2 million every year, plus the gotaways, hundreds of thousands, plus, Jack, the ones we never see who cross the border. So we cannot absorb this influx of people coming here illegally into our state and into our country. We used to spend, every time I would write the budget in the past, up until Biden came into office, we spent about $800 million on the budget. We do a two-year budget, $400 million a year. And this past budget is $4 billion of our Texas taxpayer money. Anyone who drowns in the river, anyone who is thrown into sex slavery, any criminal that crosses the border, which they do, and all those things I just described happen every day, it's Joe Biden's fault. He said, keep coming, just keep coming. So this all goes back to him. We're just trying to protect our state, protect our country the best of our ability when the federal government's not doing the job. But of course, we want to be we want to do everything we do in the most humane way that we possibly can.
And do everything you do, what did he say? He said, do everything we can do in the most humane way possible. I mean, I'm sorry, these, even before these revelations came out, the stories we were getting of deaths at the border were unacceptable. To be facing something like that and to basically, you know, say, oh, yeah, we'll look into it. But also, we're doing a really good job here, is like Gestapo level kind of stuff. This is, you know, it's not even like the kind of traditional, like, oh, we're going to feign pain and, you know, and compassion on these things. It is, this is Biden's fault. And also, we're doing a really good job by putting barbed wire on the Rio Grande.
Yeah. And any dead bodies are good propaganda for the message that we're trying to send, which is don't come.
And, you know, this is affecting people in all sorts of, you know, ways. And the first and foremost is the people crossing the border and dying this way. I've talked about how Texas National Guardsmen have died and drowned in the Rio Grande because they haven't been doing enough to adequately protect them, right? People who were there working a job for the Texas state government. But even ranchers on the border now are fighting with the state government because the state government is now going across their land and covering in barbed wire. And the Texas state government, this is from Ben Wormand, just came out a couple hours ago. He's the reporter at the Houston Chronicle who first broke this entire story. You know, is talking about there's a pecan farmer in Eagle Pass where a lot of these stories are taking place, where a pregnant woman was caught in state-deployed razor wire, said officials working for Governor Greg Abbott's border security initiative are refusing to take it down despite his repeated requests. And what they're being told is that they have complete authority because of the disaster declaration to cover up your personal and private property, right? I'm not typically going to cry too much about property rights on this show, but in this example, right, the argument from them is always all of these ranchers are struggling so much with this migrant influx. And now literally those same people, this constituency that they're saying we're doing all this for is saying, hey, we don't want there to be barbed wire all around our community, all around our land, because it's a massive impediment. It's something I could very easily get caught up in, or my animals get caught up in, or these people get caught up in. We don't want it. And they're being told, no, we're going to do this because it plays really well on television for Bubba's in Dallas, for people in Tennessee when Abbott decides he wants to run for president, right? So that we can make this kind of political statement at the cost of human lives, at your personal safety, and in your name. At the end of the day, I mean, like, the politics is you can never accept defeat. This doesn't represent Texas. It doesn't represent Texans. People are mad about this. People don't want this kind of thing to be done. The most direct, the fastest way to deal with this crisis is for the federal government to get involved and say, no, we are not going to allow a state governor to put up weapons of war on our southern border. Full stop. That's it. You do not have the authority. We do not recognize your authority to do that. And we're going to pull those up right now. That is the quickest solution. The longer solution, the one that we more likely might have to pursue, is to support aid organizations on the border that are out there helping migrants, making sure that, like, when these DPS psychos are saying we're not going to give people water in 105 degree heat, that we're there giving people water, giving them shelter, giving them information and help and coordinating, getting them to their destinations. But most importantly, it goes back to what we're talking about across the board, is that we need a different kind of politics in this state and in this country that puts human rights, that puts working people first, because the current regime is not working for any of us, and it is only leading to more and more and more barbarism.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, this water stuff goes back a while. Like, I remember Vice documentaries. I don't know if it was in Obama's era or if it was early Trump, but, like, border guys going around and seeking out stashed water canteens and dumping them out.
Dumping them.
The other thing this has, and you mentioned Gestapo and Nazis, and I will draw another parallel, which is that this is being used to mask a failure of capitalists. J.D. Vance was going on about the impact of all the migration on low-income like housing and things like that. And what that is doing is blaming some of the most marginalized, oppressed people that we have in the world right now for a problem by your local real estate industry. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what's happening. Here's this new research by the Joint Center for Housing Studies from Harvard University, and I will cite Harvard because it's good, good info. But you look at, like, you can go by here and select a state, but the general rule is that the rentals for a high income have gone up compared to, this is 2011 versus 2021. And for low income, we've gone down. I mean, this is, and you just pick a random state. Let's pick California. Of course, see that everywhere. Hi, you see Colorado. Like, you know, it's the story. There's way more, like 600, 800, way more 800, 1,000. And now the only ones that are experiencing growth are high, like expensive rent. So like that's where this is coming from. This is being used. These people are being scapegoated like Jews were. Like, I'm like, that's exactly where we're at here.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. It's what they're doing is there are problems that people are experiencing in this country because of capitalism, low wages, really expensive rents, high food costs, etc. Yeah, and instead of blaming the capitalist, the guy who's actually making money off of this, yeah, let's blame these people who are trying to cross over a river in 100-degree weather with everything that they own on their backs, literally pregnant at times, carrying children with them. I mean, it is truly some of the most dehumanizing, but also a very tactical decision because, yeah, Dan Patrick, Greg Abbott, J.D. Vance, Trump, a lot of them don't want to talk about bosses. Frankly, neither do Joe Biden or the vast majority of the Democratic Party either.
Nope. And that's so partially why we're in this position where we can't move anywhere but backwards on it.
So instead of having like a reasonable border policy, you get to scapegoat it, and not just scapegoat it. At this point, like, it's almost quaint to talk about the scapegoating when we're talking about the human life and the human cost of this kind of thing. It's gone beyond scapegoat.
Sacrifice.
Yeah. So, I mean, this touches on a lot of different things, and we'll certainly continue to cover it. But remember, these things cascade, you know, from the early reports of how Abbott is sort of consolidating power to be able to do things like this to now it's a brutal realization on the border. And don't let these things move on. Like, don't let this news cycle move on. There needs to be sustained pressure on the Biden administration to get involved, because they'd be very happy for this to be a news cycle that is, you know, basically politically helpful for them, right? Oh, Republicans are bad, right? And they are. Republicans are bad, right? But if they are as bad as you say, which they are, what are you going to do about it beyond trying to fundraise off of it? And we can't accept that kind of shit anymore. Well, folks, we're going to jump. I mean, you know, these stories are very different in a lot of ways, but also very similar in the kind of dehumanization and cruelty that folks are feeling. We're going to go and talk a little bit about Israel-Palestine. We had Basil Adra on the show, who was telling us about what is likely to be one of the largest expulsion events in Palestine since 1967 in the West Bank. It's a truly, truly, you know, brutal story. And there's an American connection. This is our money. This is our political institutions that are supporting the state. And on the international level, as we'll get into in the interview, what Israel is doing and has been doing is very clearly out of step with international law. Well, the problem with international law is you need to have some organizations, institutions, and forces are willing to support it. There's been a lack of interest from the United States government and other major European players investigating this. Let's jump to that real fast. We'll be back on the other side.
See you, folks.
Welcome back, Left Reckoners. David here. I'm joined right now by Basil Adra, who is a reporter with 972 Magazine and Local Call, who wrote a piece along with Yuval Abraham in The Nation. The destruction of this Palestinian community was greenlighted by Israel's Supreme Court. Thank you so much for taking some time to join us here on Left Reckoning today.
Thank you and your audience for having me.
No, I mean, this is a really important, story, and, you know, there's a lot of importance, particularly for our American audience, to be paying attention to what's happening in Palestine, because the U.S. plays a role here. But, I mean, could you talk a little bit about this Supreme Court decision? We're talking particularly about Masfar Yatta, which is a larger region in the West Bank. if this decision from the Supreme Court goes through, if the policies are enacted, as you noted in your piece, this will be one of the largest expulsions, population transfers of people in the West Bank since 1967. Could you sketch out a little bit about, you know, Masfer Yatta, like, and who controls it, who lives there for our audience who might not be familiar?
So, yeah, Masfer Yatta is in the southern occupied West Bank. It's in the West Bank and on the border of the 1948. We are like 20 communities. Our livelihood in the history and keep until now is farmers. We keep sheep. We have 20 small villages that all in these villages, people are farmers that keep sheep and planting the seeds and olive trees and living this simple life. And in the past, like in the last, like in the before 50 years and 100 years and 200 years, and in the history, the people digged caves to live in them as houses, and was really, like, as we hear from our grandparents, a simple and a good life that they used to live as farmers here, but start to be like under control, and people start to be harmed in their livelihood mainly. Since 1967, since the Israeli occupation forces took over this land and start like controlling everything about it. So in the 80s, the Israeli occupation forces started three designations in order to legitimize the presence of the Israeli civilian settlers like living in our land in Masfer Yatta and all over like Area C, what's so called Area C in the West Bank. So first thing, they designated a huge piece of land of our like lands in Masfer Yatta as a state land. And this state land goes exclusively to the settlers to build the settlements and outposts and farms. And in that time, within the same year, they started to build three settlements here in Masfer Yatta, and one of them just a few hundred meters away from my home and from my community. Mm-hmm. And then there is the other designation, which is the third one. It's like they designated 14 community out of the 20 as a firing zone, which is mean that this land would go only for the Israeli occupation army to do military exercises on it. And actually, an Israeli politician at that time, Ariel Sharon, who was a minister for the ministry for the agriculture ministry, wrote in his secret documentation that was released last year, just like 40 years after the designation, that he is designating these 14 communities as a firing zone, not for the soldiers. It is for the settlers to build the settlements there and to expel out the Palestinians. And they will use the word firing zone and military area for the pretext in the court. Since that designation until last May, they've been putting pressure, like increasing each like year, the pressure on the residents of Masfer Yatta to take them and to drive them away from their homes, especially from these 14 communities. So in 1999, they invaded these villages, and they, with the heavy forces and the military trucks and big vehicles, and put all the stuff inside them. And also they put above this the children and old men and the women, and they beat up some of the men and arrest them and drive away the rest with their sheep. That day, 700 Palestinians were made homeless by Israel. This was very traumatic and very, very horrifying, like, action to be done. By a chance, there was, like, a human rights organizations who would come to cover the daily harassments by the Israeli military forces in the area. And that thing happened, so they got to film this and to take photos and to publish it. And that year, like, there was also the Israeli liberal left wing Zionists playing a role in that, and they don't want to be embarrassed in front of the international community that the picture is going outside that the Israeli occupation forces like taking Palestinian 700 people in trucks and transferring them out. So 6 months later from that action, and within the steadfastness of the Palestinians who really fight to go back to their land, they were every day got beaten by the soldiers and got arrested, and they confiscate their sheep and their tractors. So the court find itself under pressure of international community, human rights organizations, and the people who appealed on what happened with them, and who kept fighting on the ground for their land because they don't have any place, any other place to go for it, like to go live in it. So what happened, the court decided in March 2000 that the residents of Masafer Yatta can go back live in their land until the final decision will come out. So then, since then, until last May, people were really fighting. I am personally like growing up in this situation where I witnessed and document hundreds of the demolitions that going on weekly by the Israeli occupation forces against the Palestinians. And within the same time, they were able to go back to their land. Immediately, the Israeli army allowed the settlers to build another like 4 outposts. They kept saying these outposts are illegal, but these 3 of the outposts were built in the firing zone also. But the settlers there facilitated to have electricity, clean water, and public transportations, asphalt, and big bulldozers come to dig for their homes and their building. I never saw like an Israeli bulldozer going inside, demolish this, while they keep saying it's illegal. So you have this picture that they're coming weekly to do these demolitions against our communities, and at the same time facilitating for the settlers to expand more and more into our land. And this is just crazy to imagine it. I grew up in this situation where I live in a community that just got destroyed. My people go apply for the Israeli army, like to request of permissions, paying a lot of money, wasting money and time, and seeking to have permissions for the villages, for the houses. Always the same, like result, reject and demolition. Mm-hmm. 0.5% of our Palestinians request in the West Bank to get like permissions to build houses or water well or school or anything in their communities, it's reject. With the recent government, now it's zero. No permission. Like even the 1.5%, it's deleted. So what happened all these years, this is what was going on. In order, like the Israeli army put the people under daily pressure. They would go and invade the houses in the night, in the tents, like taking the people outside, the children, and they like fake to do research inside the houses, like terrorizing the people, damaging properties, and taking them out in the cold, let them wait outside until the soldiers like do their like fake research in the houses. In the day, they would come back with a bulldozer and bulldozer these houses, bulldozering the roads. In 2019 was like a massive day where I document this from 8 in the morning until 3 in the afternoon. Israeli forces brought huge bulldozers and cut down 25 kilometers of water pipe that was giving like a little bit of water for all the communities of Masafer Yatta. It was like a whole day. They were digging roads and taking the pipe outside and cutting it. So to put the people under pressure that they would leave by themselves from this land, that they would not find any other solution except leaving it, and didn't work. So what happened last May, the 4th of May, the High Court came out with this final decision, which is to ignore all the evidence about the Palestinians living in this, the history, the elements for the community living here, the international law, the international human rights law, the international community that looking at this situation, they ignored everything about it, just believe their soldier, because it's a political case. There is this court, we don't vote for it. We don't vote for the laws that controlling our life as Palestinians in this area. It's all controlled by a foreign army who's imposing everything by force, by power, by guns. So the final decision was to ignore everything and just to give the green light for the Israeli military occupation to drive away over than 1,300 Palestinians from these communities away, and to give this land for, as they still claiming, a firing zone. So since this decision come out in last May, for 2 months they've been driving like 3 to 4 tanks and huge bulldozers, and they do explosions on the ground. They put targets for the soldiers in the roads where the people walking and shot at them. The tanks driving between the houses and on the fields, on the crops of the Palestinians, and prevent any movement. The soldiers do checkpoints, prevent any movement in between, within the communities or outside or inside these communities. Two villages stayed under sewage. They established like a metal gates and caravans for the soldiers to stay 24 hours. The residents of these communities wait every time they want to pass in and out to their community, like to go buy their stuff and go inside or going to the doctors, and they want to go back to their village between 6 to 8 hours each time they want to go in and out. School children have been waiting there, like, and search their bags and their bodies and ask them for IDs, and they were really harassed by the soldiers and waiting hours under the sun. Their teachers have been prevented to go in and was beaten up by the soldiers and detained for hours. The cars of those teachers were confiscated under the pretext that they are moving on a firing zone area, and lawyers and journalists and activist cars have been confiscated. Only military and settlers cars have, it's driving in this like 14 communities, and settlers go for fun like with motorcycles and with four wheels cars to drive on the mountains and on the roads. And over than that, they wiped out 15 like houses and special properties for the residents of these communities. I want to speak about one new thing happened in the, after the decision, and really living like it's a traumatic for me. One normal day in November, like in the morning, while students in a primary school in Masafer Yatta were had their classroom classes as usual, heavily forces invaded their classroom at eight, like with, like in the time they started their class. The soldiers ran like crazy to the doors of these classrooms, slammed the doors, and the other group of soldiers start pushing us away as journalists and parents. And one soldier start throwing sun grenades. When the first sun grenade like were bombed, the students, these kids really opened the windows of the of their classrooms, taking some of their books and start jumping from the windows and crying and running away. And the soldiers keep running after them, like to make sure they're leaving away from around the building. And the soldiers went inside the school, taking their bags and balloons and tables and chairs, and taking them to military vehicles, confiscating them, stealing them. And then a bulldozer were driven in and owned by a settler who just living in an illegal outpost nearby in our land, come in, and for like some minutes he drove all, like he bulldozed all the school and smashed it under the eyes of everyone. I mean, this is the American money that they are funding it to this foreign military that controls everything to in order to destroy our life. I mean, Americans should know that their money going to destroy our schools, our water system, our solar panels, our roads, our homes, and these things has nothing to do with the Israeli security or the things that they are talking about. It's, we want just normal life as a human living on our land as a people who owns this land and having all the evidence to prove that this is our land, and we just want to build our homes, our schools, and to have clean water and lights at night, and to sleep really safely. I don't feel safe sleeping at night because last year they invaded my home about 7 times at night. They detained my father, they harassed us, they broke the door of my room in order to get inside it. And all these soldiers come with masks on their faces, with long guns, and with like 30 soldiers, they will invade the village. They will prevent anyone to move and make arrests in the village, throwing stun grenades just for fun. I filmed this and I posted, and it's just so crazy how this is can keep go on, and how there is a fight in the US to speak if Israel is a racist state or not a racist state. What do you want after all the evidence that you got from Amnesty, Human Rights Watch, Beit Salem, the biggest Israeli human rights like organization, and the evidence that we film every day and the harassments that we are talking about? We just don't want to be controlled by a foreign army who controls everything about our life in order to drive us away. Nothing here about security, nothing here about religion. It's all political to steal our land and to annex it. This is why they are creating this like And those Israelis who's now chanting for democracy and against the, what's the, to the judicial revolution, or I don't know what they call it. Where were them when this like high court decided last year about Masafer Yatta to drive away 1,300 Palestinians? Actually, the one that read this, wrote this judgment is a settler himself living in a settlement in the West Bank and like violating the international law, and still can be a judge and deciding the future of 1,300 residents of Masafer Yatta. Where were these Israelis who's now chanting for democracy? Where were them about these decisions? We also deserve our like freedom, deserve to choose and to vote for our leaders, deserve to vote for the laws that control my life and controls to give me permission for a home or not. And they don't have this, and I'm like 27-year-old, and my parents doesn't have this rule or this like freedom.
Well, I mean, you know, I want to talk a little bit more about life on the ground, but, you know, and I totally agree with what you were just saying. But as you outline in your piece, I mean, even for like a decision from the Israeli Supreme Court, this one seemed extremely cynical, right? It was very clearly political. Y'all note, there is a researcher whose work they cited in the case to sort of deny the history of Palestinians living in that area. And that researcher, y'all got some quotes from him, and he was horrified that his work was being used in this way. I mean, could you break down, you know, some of the aspects of, I mean, the case is like, it's horrifying in like what it's doing, but also like the way that it's justified is just ludicrous, in my opinion.
Yes, so for the case, like we brought like experts, for example, in the history and in archaeological sites to prove for the court that the people of that we have been living in Masafer Yatta for hundreds of years, and we didn't come after it was designated as a firing zone, as the Israeli military forces are claiming. There was like, for example, shops, notebooks from the 40s in the area here. There was aerial footage from 1948 also, that showing there was buildings, for example, in the villages of Masafer Yatta. So the judge answered on that, oh, there is buildings, but how you can prove there was a life inside these buildings? So you see like how they are ignoring and how they are throwing this away. An Israeli writer who came into Masafer Yatta in the 30s, and this like what he wrote was used in the court as evidence that in the 30s there was people living here, and the caves that are like 100 year and 200 year old and lived by the people of Masafer Yatta here. Also the documents of Ariel Sharon that he wrote, that we want to designate Masafer Yatta as a firing zone in order to use it for the settlements and the settlers and to stop the expansion of the Arabs, as he said, to create their state. So all of this were ignored because the judge were a settler. He's a settler that live in the settlement, and he works from his perspective, from what he need, from his goal as a settler is to take more land and to expel more Palestinians out of the land and to take more land that will be empty for the settlers and the settlements.
Yeah, I mean, it's truly horrifying. I mean, so in a second, I want to talk about your run-in with the security forces. But before that, I mean, you know, you've been sort of talking about this a bit. I mean, you were talking about this, you know, harassment and this terrorizing of children in their school. But could you talk about, you know, sort of daily life now that, like, literally, there are security forces practicing with live ammunition near where people are living? I mean, can you talk about this kind of shift, right? There's always been this occupation, but literally just hearing the sounds of like military machines and warfare, like how does that affect, you know, daily life for people living in the area?
So when they are like announced that there is like a military exercise going on to be in the area, there's no movement. Shepherds can't go outside to the fields because the tanks are driving between the houses and on the crops itself to destroy them. Shepherds are scared to go outside and it's unsafe. and soldiers put like explosion and on the ground and they explode them. They do like for long distance the checkpoints. They prevent anyone to go in or out from the communities. Anyone like journalists like me, hard to move from a village to another to document what's going on. They also, as I mentioned, put sit targets on the road and really, literally they let the soldiers shoot it at them like with live bullets and on the road. And last year, what they also shot from the tank, and one of the bullet, it's big bullet, hit one of the houses on the roof, and because the roof were metal, this big bullet stuck on the roof, and we called the army through the lawyers that the training is causing like harms for the houses, and people were afraid. The family were inside the house when the bullet hit it. And they came like with a one military jeep and checked, and they said, no, there's nothing here. Nothing. We did nothing with the training. By chance, there was a visit for the European embassies and the European representative to this village to tell them about the Masafer Yatta case. And the people cut the roof of the house in front of the European representative, and they took out the bullet. And it was a huge bullet that was shot from a tank. And no one have a tank in this area except the Israeli occupation forces. Who could have a tank? And when we filmed when we took pictures of this bullet and take it to them, they said, oh, it's maybe happened because of our training. What mean maybe? Who else have this, yeah, like... And you know, they played this game as they shot Shireen Abu Akleh, the journalist in Jenin. They said, no, it's not us. It's the Palestinians. And then maybe it's us. And indeed, oh, it was a mistake by us. The journalist was shot by the Israeli soldiers. So even like, because there's no consequences for their crimes and for the acts that they are doing. They shot like a house with a bullet of a tank, and no one will do anything to them. So why they would care about it? So this is like the impunity that they are covered by it's covering Israeli government always by the US mainly and by the biggest like countries in Europe, that they don't help us to go to the ICC. They don't do anything to end this occupation except like some condemnations here and there and some posts in social media. But there's no actions to done. And it is the time of to act against the apartheid and against the racism that we are facing every day in our life.
I definitely want to get to the international stuff in just one second. But before we get there, you had a run-in with security forces last week, and I can't imagine that, you know, the mobilization, militarization has made it easy to do what you do, which is cover what's happening in the region. I mean, could you break down your experience with being detained recently?
So there was like there's daily harassment by the settlers. That's not pogrom as happening pogrom where everyone talk about it, but there is a daily harassment that no one like talk about it almost, where the settlers drive that come. This is like a new policy that they are doing, creating new farms, and they would go with the sheep from to the Palestinian special properties to the crops in order to harass the Palestinians and to make them tired from their like staying there, because the Israeli military occupation can't just confiscate this land because the laws still prevent them from confiscating like special properties. So that what they would go, they invest in the settlers' daily violence and harassments, that the settler would go day after day to the Palestinian fields in order to make them tired going to this field. So the settler would go there and like graze his sheep and claim the Palestinian throw at him stone, to the army would come and arrest this Palestinian, take him to the jail for several days, paying a high fine, and then it would be released. And this game until the Palestinian would be tired from going to his land, and then it ended up to the settlers. So this like family called me that the settler grazed in their field and asked me to come film him. So when I went there, more settlers joined, and one was driving the car very crazy, and then he claimed that Barsin throwed at him stones. So the army arrived there, the police arrived there, and then start to invade, like huge forces invaded like my village and start to attack people literally and beating them up and searching houses for the kids who throw stones at them, and as they claimed. And then officer like came to me and told me, give me your ID and your phone. I gave him and he said, you have to open your phone because you are here and filming. This is what the settler told him. I told him, I am a journalist and I have card and you can't just do it. There's a police is here and he didn't ask for it. And there's rules for this. And he said, listen, the rules take like long time. I want you to open your phone now and to show me the videos and I release you, or there is a longer way to take the videos. I told him this is illegal and you can't just do that. He said, okay. He called on the phone for another military jeep that arrived and they took me behind this jeep, start handcuffed me. When they were doing that, the settler were still there and start like insulting me and raising his middle finger to me. The soldiers were like smiling and handcuffing me, putting like a cloth on my eyes to cover them and put me in the jeep and start driving away. And then they transfer me from the jeep to another like van of the soldiers, and who start also insulting me, and they took me like the drive, I don't know where, I couldn't see. It's mental thing that you can't see, you can't understand the language, except like they know the bad words in Arabic that they are cursing me with it. And like they kept driving until we arrived in a place, I assume it's a military base, and they put me down, start pushing me hard to walk with them. I was like trying to ask them that I won't understand what's happening, where I am. And they just kept telling me to shut up and shut your mouth and pushed me and grabbed the chair and make me sit on it and then grab the chair to the sun and make me sit there and just try to like say bullshit. Like, why don't you live in Jenin? Why you don't go to Jenin if you are a journalist for Al Jazeera? And then like asking me, if you are an educated person, why you ended up in a military base with a soldier handcuffed? I told him, if you are educated enough, you would not be in this place and in this military base. And they like kept telling me that, like telling me that I'm a dog and they know who I am and I'm writing anti-Israeli reports and this shit, like for several hours under sun. Then the same officer came and take me to the jeep and take me to the entrance of my village, and he gave me my phone and my ID that was in his pocket for all this time, and I don't know what he did into it. And this is not the first time. Just last May, I was beaten up and assaulted by four Israeli soldiers for like 40 minutes only because I went to film them trying to demolish like a shelter for my neighbor. And they decided like immediately to arrest me violently. I was protesting that this is illegal. There's no excuse. I'm just filming. They didn't care. They really grabbed me on the ground and beat me up. And later I was like hospitalized because of that. And just, this is like recently, but almost each time I go to the field, they are like blocking us and preventing us and try to arrest us and create a flying checkpoint on the way where we are driving in order, for example, to prevent us from reaching the place where they are demolishing or doing something. And also they confiscate the cars for journalists and activists when we go to, for example, to the communities that designated as a firing zone under pretext that this civilian car can't be in a firing zone area.
Well, you know, it's just awful. You know, I can't wrap my head around it. In the last couple of minutes, I mean, you know, this is very clearly not in step with international law. I mean, could you talk a little bit about what you and other people in the area would like to see from the international community, and in particular the United States, on this issue, something that's more significant than, for example, condemnations from politicians from time to time?
It's crazy. I mean, today we are more than ever really disappointed and angry because with the last government, it's very clear more racism toward us. There is like a massive of settlers building in the area here, even in Masafriyata, where the court decided that civilians can't live here. The settlers are creating a new outpost and attacking people really every day. Like I'm getting calls like, and the activists here with me, getting calls like every day from different communities. We are not able even to cover this, that the settlers going and harassing these people. As I mentioned, not necessarily the pogroms, but the settlers go graze near the people's houses and chase shepherds away. They're harming the livelihood of the people, the food of the people. So in order to make them live away. Recently, they also start to come to the water wells that the people dig to and collected the water from the rain, and they cannot just waste this water. The people call the police, the army, they ignore them. They just come to harass the Palestinians when they arrive, and they would say, "This settler, they are kids, and we can't do anything to them. You can't do anything to them." And the soldiers would stay with them around, and the settlers that create, like, literally, they're building like tents for their sheep above the well, the only water resource for the communities in Masafer Yatta, and they stay there with the soldiers, and we look at the international community that always ask Israel, like, in their condemnations, to not change the status quo, but the status quo are very, very bad for us to live in it, and there is no status quo. The settlers and the army have all the power to change the facts, and they're de facto on the ground, and this is what they are doing. They are going from a piece of the land after another one, from a village after another. It's the first time for me to watch Palestinian people demolishing their tents and houses and leaving. Near Ramallah, a whole community, 200 people just left their community because settlers that kept like attacking them every night, and one day they like steal 337 sheep from one shepherd under protection of the police and the army. Just a settler arrived there and claimed that this sheep belonged to him, and he bring another like settlers that they decide to take this sheep away. So the Palestinians decided that their turn coming one after one, so they decided to move. Here in the South Hebron Hills area, really families are start like to demolish their tents and houses and leave their homes because of the settlers like daily harassments, and the soldiers come invade the houses in the night and arrest like residents. Well, the international community not doing anything on that, but the opposite, like a lot of money. For example, there are six Israeli settlers like organizations are registered in New York as a charities, and they're getting $60 million each year in order to damage our life, and they're creating like huge farms and on our land for the cows, for the sheep, for the chicken, for the vineyard, for the cherries, and they're getting water for all these farms. Why us Palestinians in this heat we've don't have clean water to drink in the day, while they have these like huge farms to make economy for these settlements, and all of it, it's money from the US that's coming here, or for the military to commit these demolitions and night invasions and arresting people, or for the settlers who's like occupying this land and colonize it. So Americans should look after their money, and this act should stop, and they should support us as Palestinians to get our freedom and our dignity and our life as human beings.
I can't agree more, and I think there's a tremendous responsibility for people in the U.S. To be paying attention to this and advocating for our government to change its policies, because it's not just a bystander. In fact, it's an actor in the area. Bezalel, thank you so much for spending some time with us today on Left Reckoning. We'll link to your work and to this piece, and really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you.
Very grateful.
Thank you, David, for doing that.
What's happening?
Bezalel, that's heroic, personal fortitude in the face to document something like that we're dealing with. And he's right that this is the time. And, you know, we'd be remiss to say David's going to talk about more about this on Thursday. Michael's third anniversary of Michael's passing's coming up. Mm-hmm. And there was that one moment, I forget what it was, when everyone was passing around Michael at that university talking about taking that question from that Jewish student saying, you know, how do you square your Jewish values with opposing Israel? And Michael was very matter of fact about it and very clear, and to the point where like Gigi Hadid is like sharing it and stuff like that. And yeah. The thing is like I used to feel this every day, and I feel it slightly rare now, but pangs of like, I wonder where Michael would be at. about X or Y. And I mean, that's where he was when he was alive. And I can only imagine, like, and him working with him and you know, another Jewish broadcaster, Sam Cedar, like, actually gave me, just a white guy from the Midwest, more confidence to speak forthrightly about an issue which is salting the earth in the UK right now with regards to politics. We've talked with Heather Mendick about the anti-Semitism stuff used as an attack on the left, just blatantly. And my patience is gone, right? And look, interpersonal anti-Semitism is absolutely disgusting thing. I absolutely resent the implication that people on the left are okay with it. It's fucking gross. That is being used like this to support that, those fucking bulldozers, is disgusting. And like, and that we have now going on in our Congress, mentioned by Basil, like on top of all the shit he's dealing with, he has to deal with our Congress, coming, going into full-on conniption because, well, just to set the table, Pramila Jayapal, leader of the Progressive Caucus. Wait,
before we move on, can I just share a quick Michael one?
Of course.
It's fast, and that's why I love it so much. One of my favorite Michael lines on Israel, I don't know if it just hits me hard versus other people, but I just remember him one time doing a segment like this, and at the end he goes, how does anyone defend this place?
Yes, exactly.
It's like cut right through it.
Right, exactly. And like that's where, and look, like, obviously, Michael would have plenty of, he has a different mode to switch into, like, yes, the horrors of the Holocaust and things like that. But the way that is deployed is toxic. And, you know, the way that he, like, Michael was really, like, over identity politics deployed for reactionary purposes because of his, you know, time. He's talked about this many times, I mean, probably in that speech, debating family members saying, well, what about, you know, the history we all know about the Holocaust. Like, yes, that doesn't, that is not justification. And to use that for propaganda to justify this is a further, like, historical sin that you should not want to envelop people in. And so, yeah.
You set this up, yeah.
So Pramila Jayapal was at Netroots Nation in Chicago, and some Palestinian activists stood up and started, you know, basically speaking out for this sort of thing. Oops, sorry, my autoplay went. And Jayapal stood up and said, among other things, like, Israel is a racist nation. And then walked it back, said, oh, I'm sorry I said that. I didn't mean it's a racist nation. I mean, like, the powers, the like present governing structures and that sort of thing, and the policies, right? But I don't mean to get on the whole endeavor, right? Which I think, like, we kind of do need to start talking about that sort of, like, long-term history of, like, sure, I think there are plenty of people who looked, and you have the, like, on the best, you have the kibbutz, the sort of, like, socialist Jews who had, like, I have no doubt that there's thousands of people that had good intentions, but the ultimate practice and has been one of just nationalism and exclusionary nationalism, right? And so, anyway, now that wasn't enough, obviously, to put the people that are saying Pramila Jayapal is anti-Semitic for having that criticism of Israel, which I think should be, I don't know, fairly uncontroversial at this point. And so now there's this resolution that the House Republicans brought up. And it just passed. The resolution states Israel is not a racist or apartheid state. So we're just lying now.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, say if we, like, it, even, like, I mean, and we'll play a clip from Rashida. You know, like, it's just not, this is just what terms mean. You would have, if we'd act, I mean, yeah, like,
the, I mean, I'm sorry, like, on the apartheid thing, it's just like, when Desmond Tutu, you know, somebody who knows a thing or two about apartheid, says this is an apartheid system, I'm inclined to agree with him versus a bunch of Republicans in the United States of America, a state that was very happy to support South Africa up until the very, very, very bitter end.
Yeah, exactly. So the results are in. This is a pro. I believe she's actually Aviva Klumpas. What is her background? I think she's a spokesperson of some type. But anyway, a resolution said Israel's not a racist or apartheid state. Congress rejects all forms of anti-Semitism and xenophobia. And the United States will always be a staunch partner and supporter of Israel. And then this person says it should have been followed by a unanimous vote, but the following nine representatives oppose Israel every chance they get. Now, I don't think that's necessarily true of a few of these. Maybe I'm not giving Ayanna Pressley enough credit for her previous votes. I'm glad to see her as one of the nine here. We'll just go through the nine. Andre Carson, Summer Lee, Cori Bush, Delia Ramirez, Jamal Bowman, who's good on these issues, Ilhan Rashida, and AOC.
I mean, with Bowman, sorry, did you say Bowman's good on these issues?
That's my recollection, but
no, I mean, Bowman has had very bad votes on Israel.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I mean, so much so that that's why DSA had that whole expulsion conversation around him. But I mean, I think that this is an example of like a lot of progress in the push from people within the organization to say to Bowman, you know, you have responsibility to the membership here. You know, to show up here. And, you know, one person very absent from this list is Greg Kassar, Texas progressive, Austin Santonio, who voted yes. Extremely disappointing. That's been a turn that we've seen a long time coming on this. But all I'll say is this. I mean, I have probably more to say, but I will just say this on top of all this, is that when we were just talking a little while ago, we heard a story about children sitting in a schoolhouse having the windows kicked in, stun grenades thrown in at them, in utter terror, climbing out of the building that is then bulldozed over by the Israeli state. You can't support this. There is no ifs, ands, and buts about it. It's been abundantly clear from the get-go. But with this mobilization that we've seen in the past few years, that has only been, you know, the tail end of a long, long history of abuse, systematic abuse, dehumanization of Palestinians, to sit here today with all the information available to you, and to not be able to speak about it, to ignore it, I mean, it's complicity. And it's not just complicity in the sense of like this vote one way or the other. Remember, this is U.S. money that goes to fund this system. Right? Tremendous amounts of American aid go to support the bulldozing of schools, the bulldozing of homes, the equipment that is used to brutalize children, old folks, women, and journalists, and Palestinians across all stripes, all different kinds of people.
Yeah, I need to just refresh because I want to play this Rashida thing. So I'll be back in just 2 seconds.
You know, it's truly something that you can't sit here and say that you support human rights if you're supporting this kind of system. And something like this vote here is so clearly a symbolic attack on Jayapal for what she said. She's walked it back completely after saying some things that were correct generally about the relationship there. Walk it back completely under the slightest amount of pressure to appease MAGA people like the Republican Party and forces within the Democratic Party that like see any kind of criticism of a state that again is bulldozing schools, evacuating children from schools and bulldozing them. It's truly ludicrous to sit here and talk about you know, nuance at this point when it's very clear what side is able to get play on, you know, American television and American media and in American news reports when so many of these atrocities, we have to fight to get them out there. I mean, how many times on this show or on TMBS in the past have we tried to cover Israel-Palestine and we've seen like our videos get deboosted, get demonetized, get pulled? Like what happened with Abby Martin when we tried to play clips from her documentary on Gaza. You know, there truly is an attempt for there to be a blackout on this issue. And there's no reason that anyone who calls themselves a progressive, let alone a socialist, should be comfortable with supporting this kind of system. Let's see if we can get Matt back, because I would like to see this Rashida thing, but if he keeps popping out. Matt, are you able to get in here? All right, folks, we're going to go over to the postgame, patreon.com/leftreckoning. We're going to be talking a little bit of RFK DeSantis. We'll probably play this Rashida thing, and we'll also be taking calls and questions. You can leave us a voicemail at 1-940-289-7234. You can leave us a Discord question at Discord. You get access through Patreon. Go to the AtMod chat room. We'll be over there in the postgame in just a couple minutes, and we'll play that Rashida clip in there, friends. So see you in just a little bit.